From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Mary Margaret McBride was the first lady of radio. She was a welcome voice in millions of homes in the 30s through the 50s, pulling in 6 to 8 million listeners daily. She interviewed 30,000 guests from Eleanor Roosevelt to neighborhood plumbers and produced 15,000 shows. But she wasn't based out of New York City. This radio pioneer produced many of her shows from a Catskills barn with a live studio audience. We'll talk to Brett Berry from Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, who featured Mary Margaret McBride on a recent episode. Plus, the third annual Youth Poetry Festival is at Bethel Woods on Sunday. We'll get a preview. And artists Megan Newbeck and Randall J. Lane are here to talk to us and culture reporter Valerie Mansey. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Labor Department says consumer inflation is running higher than expected. The Consumer Price Index rose 0.4% in March over what it was in February. NPR's Rafael Nam reports that could keep the Federal Reserve from cutting interest rates for now.
Consumer prices rose 3.5% in March from a year ago. That was hotter than expected, and it's likely to have major implications for the Fed. The Fed had made clear it will not cut rates until it can see evidence inflation is easing more substantially. The central bank had previously projected it could cut rates 3 times this year. That may change now, given inflation is proving to be hotter than expected. The timing of any rate cuts is also very much up in the air. All in all, the data shows we'll have to live with higher inflation and higher interest rates for a little longer. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
President Biden has issued direct criticism of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This comes after last week's Israeli strike that killed 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen in Gaza. Biden says he disagrees with the Israeli leader's approach to the war in Gaza.
What I will tell you is I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving here, et cetera.
He spoke on Univision. Biden says he's calling for a ceasefire for 6 to 8 weeks in Gaza, and he wants Israel to allow Palestinians much more access to food and medicine. Britain's Air Force says it has participated in the largest ever airdrop of aid into Gaza. It's timed with the end of Ramadan. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
The UK defense minister posted video on social media of big boxes being pushed out of the back bay of a Royal Air Force transport aircraft. Parachutes are activated as the boxes drift down over Gaza's northern coastline. Inside are 10 tons of ready-to-eat meal packs, rice, and bottled water. The UK military says this was one of 14 aircraft from 9 countries that took part. While it increases aid to Gaza, the UK is still exporting weapons to Israel. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has ruled out suspending those amid protests at home over Israel's killing in Gaza last week of 3 British citizens working with the World Central Kitchen charity. Israel called that attack an accident and fired officers it said were responsible. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Severe thunderstorms are pounding parts of the South this morning. There have been tornado warnings for portions of southwest Louisiana. Weather forecasters say the South could get more tornadoes today, along with hail and flash flooding. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 525 points. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. I'm joined in the studio for our spring fun drive by a couple of special guests. Brett Berry, who is the producer and host of Cats Cast, the Catskill podcast. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to be talking to you about an episode that you had recently, very fascinating, about Mary Margaret McBride, dubbed the First Lady of Radio. And she produced her show back in the day at a barn in the Catskills. We're going to hear a little bit about that. But first, we're going to talk to the First Lady of the Outdoors, It's Lisa Lyons from Morgan Outdoors. Good morning.
I was afraid of what you were going to say there, Jim.
You're the first lady of outdoors. Oh. You're one of our longtime supporters and longtime listeners as well. And we had you in because we wanted to thank you for all of your support. But also, as part of this fun drive, the spring fun drive, we're asking folks about their experience with discovering Radio Catskill and how they value Radio Catskill. And you have a great story because you were telling me before we went on that you remember when the station was new, when it first started.
Yeah, what a feeling. You know, public radio, when I lived in New York City, which I did for a number of years for work, and learned to love the culture that was available there as well, was very important to me. So I worked for the City of New York, and WNYC was part of what I had to think about and work with. When I came here and there was this brand new hydro-powered station and I could meet the people that started it, I could understand, first of all, I was here for the rivers. So the fact that it was hydro-powered was like, whoa, this is really, really unique and very carefully thought through by the people who began it, Malcolm and Ann. And so that was just a really exciting experience. But I was coming up on weekends. The best part of my drive, which anybody who commutes up from the city knows, is only after you pass Middletown. And then I got this signal and there was this lovely group of people. Over time, I got to time my drive so that I'd hear certain shows. Dan Loyola, if you're out there, Dead Air was a very big part of that on Friday nights.
That was the name
for
of the
many
show.
Years. Yes. And just an enormous amount of love was going into it. So for me, it's always been very personal, very passionate, and then brought me a lot of other programming from across the nation and around the world. So I always felt like it was this wonderful, wonderful mix.
Yeah, and you said something that makes it so relevant to me too. It is a very personal relationship. I also at one point was commuting back and forth to the city and listening. As I got to Middletown, I could hear it on. Yeah. And you it's part of your life. It's part of your background. It's part of like, oh, I'm connecting to this place I want to be in, and here are the people that I know, and I feel calmer. I can breathe a sigh of relief. You know, and having that connection to the local programs, but also, as you said, the national and global programs that are available on Radio Catskill as well, really important part of the community. And yeah. And also, you know, a lot of us listen to below the, you know, the other end of the dial, the left side of the dial. Mm-hmm. And so when you listen to WNYC and you want to hear something that's similar to some of the things you experience on WNYC, like NPR programming or some of the other national programs, that's great to have that continuation, but then it's also great to have that nuance of the local area with those local voices and local perspective, which is what Radio Catskill is able to bring you.
That's right. And I would like to mention to all those listening at this particular moment that, you know, giving membership dollars for something that you might be listening to, in my case, while I'm doing chores. Mm-hmm. So I plan chores so I can listen, and then I'm learning and I'm looking out the window or whatever. Just for people to think about membership, even though it may just be for a little part of their day, maybe just when they're driving.
Right. It's important. We're listener supported. You know, we're not like those commercial radio stations. We rely on listener support. We're a nonprofit. It's how it's set up. It's you're the public in public radio. So when you donate, you keep that available for everyone, whether you're listening while you're doing your chores or making dinner or driving up or just for everybody in the community, whenever they want to tune in 24/7 too, all the throughout the clock with all the different types of programming. So call 845-482-4141 or go to WJFFradio.org. Lisa's going to be here for a little while if you want to say hi and call in, and she'll take your donation over the phone.
Great. And I'm very happy to be sharing the mic here with Brett. This is a wonderful opportunity for me to be with someone who does really meaningful work. And
Brett's
I can't wait to hear your interview with Tim.
Brett always does great stuff. And the Catskills, Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast. Tell folks about the podcast, Brett, for folks who may not be familiar.
Yeah. So, and just to go off of what Lisa was saying about the hydro-powered station. That was my first interaction with WJFF in the 1990s. I wrote an article for either the Catskill Mountain News or the Mountain Eagle about that station. And I was, you know, off to college at that point, and then got involved with public radio myself worked for WAER in Syracuse, learning how to report for public radio.
Yeah. But well, I'm proud to say that we still have a commitment to sustainability. And even though we don't have the dam outside anymore, we've moved to Liberty. Through the Recharge New York program, we receive a portion of our power from New York, which is hydropower and solar power. So from them, we get that and still committed to it, even though the physical part is still not there. Again, that commitment continues. And your commitment to the station, we hope, continues or is new. Donate now, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. So Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast. A mouthful, but tell us about it. A mouthful for me since I've been up so early.
If there's one thing I could change if I went back in time, it might be the title because nobody can pronounce it. But it comes, you know, Cat's Cast spelled K-A-A-T-S cast, which harkens back to the Dutch spelling of the Catskill names and this region, is a podcast that's published every 2 weeks and covers everything Catskills. So lots of history, sustainability, Catskills culture, oral history. So a variety of topics and guests, and most of it is done out in the field. So rather than phone interviews or bring people into a studio, most of the episodes I go out to where they are so we can incorporate some of those natural sounds.
I have to say, I admire your audio production. You have a lot of great field work, and the audio that you incorporate into them is really phenomenal.
Thank you.
The episode we're going to talk about today is about the First Lady of Radio, Mary Margaret McBride. I had never heard of Mary Margaret McBride. Apparently a really big deal. Tell us how you found Mary Margaret McBride, who produced her show in a barn in the Catskills.
Yeah, I was doing some history recordings for the Olive Library for a celebration of, I think it was the 200th celebration of their town. And so a lot of stories were coming through, and someone mentioned Mary Margaret McBride, and I too had never heard of her. And so I started doing some research, and in her day, the 1930s through the 1950s, she was a household name and had a show every day at 1 o'clock called, the announcer would say it's 1 o'clock and here is Mary Margaret McBride. So that's the title of the book that I read, a biography about her by biographer Susan Ware, who lives in Massachusetts. And found out that she was just a force to be reckoned with, and everybody knew who she was. She interviewed 30,000 guests over her career.
Amazing.
15,000 shows.
With no repeats.
No repeats. And
amazing.
And no preparation. She would bring guests in and just have a conversation for 45 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And everybody from Eleanor Roosevelt to the plumber in her building. So, she loved talking to people. It didn't matter how famous you were or not.
Wow. She was the original radio Catskill.
Yeah.
We got an excerpt from the podcast about Mary Margaret McBride, where you're talking to the author. It is Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast. Here's Brett Berry.
We are speaking with Susan Ware, author of It's 1 o'clock, and here is Mary Margaret McBride, a radio biography. Now, Mary Margaret McBride was the first lady of radio. She famously had no notes for her guests. I have many. Let's start with, how did you discover her, and why did you want to write about her?
Well, I discovered her in a kind of backwards way. I was editing a biographical dictionary called Notable American Women, and it was to include 500 women who died between 1976 and 2000. And there are many ways to compile a database, but one of the things I did was start reading New York Times obituaries. And it really was how I found Mary Margaret. And if I'm on a first name basis with her, it's because everybody was on a first name basis with her. So she's really Mary Margaret. And I remember just being intrigued that here I was, a scholar who had studied the 1930s, and I had never heard of her. And it seemed to me a chance to explore the field of radio, which is so central to 20th century American history, and also women's history, because she was a pioneer in a field which, like most fields, we think of as dominated by men. And yet when we dig a little deeper, sure enough, there are quite a few women who have made contributions, and those contributions have often been lost to history, even though these women were household names in their time. And so that kind of hook of trying to figure out, well, who is Mary Margaret and McBride and what did she mean? And then what made it possible really was that she and her manager slash partner, Stella Karn, had deposited her papers and recordings at the Library of Congress. So, you know, when I'm doing this research, it's the early 2000s. It's before digitization of everything, audio tapes and whatever. I had access to tapes, I mean, literal tapes, big tapes that had been made of her shows that I could listen to in real time in a listening booth at the Library of Congress. And so I could, in many ways, experience what it was like to be one of her listeners. I think I could have done the book without that kind of access, but it made it much more personal to me. And it made it easier for me to really imagine myself as one of her audience, a member of her audience. And I was actually, frankly, amazed at how timely and interesting many of these shows still were. And that's not true of everything that gets created in popular culture these days. But there was something that it was kind of timeless. And also she is a wonderful interviewer, and you hear it. She really puts her guests at ease. So I warn you, you have a high standard to live up to if you're playing the role of Mary Margaret McBride and I am playing the role of a guest, because that seems to be one of the reasons why her program was such a success. She would really just put her guests at ease, and it would be as if the two of them were having a conversation, no matter that one of them might be Eleanor Roosevelt or one of them might be a recent refugee from Romania. It didn't matter. It was the same kind of personal conversation which she could undertake and then make it in a way that was really accessible to her audience.
At the height of her career, she had 6 to 8 million listeners daily, which was a 20% share of broadcast media at that time slot. She was competing mostly with soap operas at the 1 o'clock time slot. And today, barely anyone remembers her. Even Jackie Leiden, who's an NPR correspondent who interviewed you in 2005, I admitted that she hadn't heard of her before your book.
And if you were a general, a writer, a celebrity, a gourmet chef, or simply had your 15 minutes of fame, you were on her show. Susan Ware has written a biography of her called It's 1 o'clock, and Here is Mary Margaret McBride. And Susan Ware joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, tell me a little bit more about her. I had never heard of her, remarkably enough. How'd she come to radio?
How did she disappear like that?
Well, I think there are two ways of answering that. One is three ways. One is our general historical amnesia. And I'm a historian. I'm always amazed when I give talks on a variety of subjects. What I assume is common knowledge often isn't anymore. So there's that. There's also a subversive way that women are often especially forgotten in history. They excel and they do great things, and then we don't hear about them anymore. And then the third thing is really the place that radio plays in media history. If you have a degree in media studies from some university, you are likely to have studied film. You know, film is sort of what everybody's concerned about. People don't really study radio. I sort of think of it as this great black hole that anybody who was involved in falls into. And it seems to be a huge shame because radio, especially in the middle part of the 20th century, before television's dominance, radio reached so many people in such an intimate and important way. It was really part of their daily lives. And I think, you know, one thing that I was thinking about getting ready for this interview, it's now been, well, my book came out in 2005. And since then, we've really seen the wonderful explosion of radio and podcasts and people realizing again the joys of listening and of being an active listener. When you just have the words and the sounds, it's up to you to fill in everything else. And that's what radio was like. So maybe people will come to more of an appreciation of where this came from, the history of radio. But poor Mary Margaret had all those things working against her. And I'm not exactly sure that my book succeeded in making her a household name again, but I felt it was very important to have her in the historical record, both for women's history and for radio history.
Well, once this podcast comes out, she's just going to explode in popularity again.
Great. I'll let my publisher know to expect the surge in sales.
Let's talk a little bit about her career. So she started as Martha Dean, a stage name.
I think really to understand how she got to the becoming Martha Dean, she started life as a journalist. And I think that that really is key to her success as a radio interviewer. Not all journalists become good radio folks, but there were things that she learned that really helped her ask questions, be curious about people and whatever. So when, you know, she's in her, I guess, her mid-30s, when she takes up radio, which is kind of late, but she takes to it right away. And I think that's because the journalism she was doing throughout the 1920s really helped prepare her for it, even though she didn't know that she was preparing for a career in radio and had no idea of the success that she would have, really to be on top of her game for the next 20 years at that point.
She used the Martha Dean moniker from 1934 to 40 on WOR for a 30-minute show, and then under her own name for NBC and ABC with a 45-minute show until 1954, so 20 years of really active radio broadcasting. And at the end of that run, she'd produced 15,000 shows, interviewed 30,000 guests, and never repeated a show. That's really incredible.
Yeah, it's quite a record. And, you know, again, another thing I was hoping to do with my book was to alert historians and journalists that there was this resource. There are these interviews with people like Paul Robeson and Zora Neale Hurston and Eleanor Roosevelt, that really are a window on the times, and that they're interesting and fun to listen to still today.
I didn't have a very easy time of finding those. I wonder if they've been digitized or if you still have to go to that listening booth at the Library of Congress to hear them.
Well, that is one way of doing it. There are some that have been selectively digitized, but again, I think it's often a low priority, digitizing old radio programs. I hope that they will be preserved because I think they are an incredibly important resource. I think one thing that probably works against them, and one of the things that she always demanded in her show, she needed the long format. 45 minutes was really the best format for her for a radio program. An hour would be okay, a little bit too long. 30 minutes, she was rushed. But 45 minutes just felt about right. And you do interviews. I'm on the receiving end of I do a lot of interviews. What a luxury to have 45 minutes for a conversation. And we don't really get that. I guess we're getting it now again with podcasts somewhat. But so often it's just these short, truncated sound bites. You know, maybe 5 minutes to promote a book or talk about something like the centennial of the 19th Amendment. But to be able to really have a conversation, it was really a gift. And she needed that. She needed that time to sort of settle in and put her guests at ease. And then also, these were commercial programs. They were not NPR. She had sponsors. and she had to find time to mention her sponsors. So she needed the extra time there, too.
You wouldn't believe that a cake mix could make such cakes. I'd say it has a homemade flavor, but sometimes homemade cakes fail. Pata cake mixes never fail. The cakes are perfection every single solitary time.
And just like she didn't prepare for her interviews, she didn't go by scripts for the sponsors. That was all ad-libbed because she really spoke about them in a way that was meaningful to her.
I think that remains one of the hardest things for me to recreate for people who haven't heard these, you know, a 45-minute Mary Margaret McBride show. Maybe 15 minutes of it would be what she called doing the products. She usually had 12 sponsors. And she would mention all of them. This is all ad-libbed. I would be forgetting them. Oh, my God, who did I leave out? But she spoke of them as if they were her best friends. I mean, things like Dromedary Gingerbread Mix and Bohack's Supermarkets. And these are products that they come alive in her telling. And then her listeners were so loyal, they would troop to the grocery store and they would buy these things. And if the grocery store didn't have them, they would say, well, Mary Margaret mentioned these. You better get them. And they would.
I love it. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're talking to Brett Berry from the Cats Cast podcast and his recent episode about Mary Margaret McBride, the first lady of radio. She produced over 15,000 shows, no repeats, interviewed 30,000 guests, and she did that all here in the Catskills. Where was her studio in the Catskills?
She did some in the Catskills. She also lived in New York City where she did the majority of her work. But as she got older, she renovated a barn in West Shokan near the Ashokan Reservoir and did many shows from there. With celebrity guests like Eleanor Roosevelt, who I guess just popped over the river and joined her because they were good friends.
Wow. And you know, I mentioned we were talking while we were listening a little bit there that she did this all here, but you made sure to mention that this was a national show. This was something that went all over.
It was nationally syndicated. She had a huge fan base in New York City. And in fact, for her 10th and 15th anniversary years, she packed Yankee Stadium and Madison Square Garden.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Sold out.
Wow. Wow. Take that, Elton John.
Yeah. She had, it's a apples to apples comparison. She had more listeners, daily listeners, than the Today Show has viewers today.
Wow. Mary Margaret McBride, the first lady of radio. We're going to hear a little bit more after a quick break where we have to get in one of our sponsors, not the Dromedary Gingerbread Mix, but we'll
need
be
to
right.
Find that.
I do too. We'll be back. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Winter hours online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Hi, I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. I report on the shakeups, challenges, and trends in the news industry, including here at NPR, because sometimes the media is the story. I also cover the relationships between the press and politicians and how news outlets are fighting disinformation. All of this is even more relevant in an election year. Please help NPR keep trustworthy information coming your way by making a donation to this station today. And thanks.
Donate now during our spring fund drive at wjffradio.org.
Yes, it's our Spring Fund Drive. We need to hear from you at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. Make a donation of any amount to support the news and information and entertainment that you hear on Radio Catskill, including Radio Chatskill, which we bring you as much different voice and perspective from the communities we can. And one of those is from Brett Berry from the Cats Cast podcast, the Catskills podcast. And he's bringing us a really great story of Mary Margaret McBride. She was the first lady of radio. She was in millions of homes in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. She pulled in 6 to 8 million listeners daily. Amazing. A little less than, we get a little less than that, actually. But We are talking to Brett about it, and we're listening to some of the podcast as well. Here's a little bit more of the CatsCast podcast, the Catskills podcast featuring Mary Margaret McBride.
1 o'clock, and here is Mary Margaret McBride.
Who has been in a steady state since about 9 o'clock, but no, earlier than that, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, last night, of her heart just turning somersaults inside of her. That was watching your picture and seeing those raft scenes. And I tell you what really just did me in was it when that first airplane, when you could hear the noise of it.
Well, critics of the day called her a brilliant interviewer and at the same time would dismiss her as a serious journalist or radio host. Is that disconnect having to do with the fact that she is a woman, that she was broadcasting in the daytime? Are there other factors at play there?
Well, I think it's both those things, that she's a woman. And, you know, some of the coverage in places like Time and Life, they used words like goo, and they really couldn't take her seriously. And also there was this dichotomy, it's actually a false dichotomy, where people at the time thought that daytime radio was soap operas and silly things devoted to brainless housewives.
The guiding light. Brought to you by the makers of P&G soap.
And evening radio was serious when the men come home from work, and this is what you listen to.
Presenting the distinguished international news commentator and foreign correspondent, Raymond Graham Swing. This is another of his programs known as World Events, on which Mr. Swing gives his interpretation of international affairs.
And so she was a woman, and she was on daytime radio, and those things worked against her. But she was a superb journalist and a superb radio interviewer, and she was serving an enormous need for her audience at the time. And that was why they were so loyal. She's taking women seriously at a time when American culture and society did not always take women seriously. She realized that they were hungry for news of books and Broadway and what was going on in Europe and what was going on in the World War and also what she had for dinner last night. There was really, again, a need for connection that only radio could provide at this point. This happened every day, and it happened every day at 1 o'clock. And people literally designed their days around being able to sit down and just listening to Mary Margaret. And, you know, the other thing is she never announced in advance who her guests are, but in some ways that was part of the attraction. It also is one reason why subversively, she could sometimes get on controversial people, especially African Americans. Voice does not necessarily give away one's racial and ethnic background. And by the time an identifying detail might have surfaced, hopefully the person being interviewed had already caught the imagination and interest of the listeners, and their race or ethnicity no longer mattered. And I think that she consciously exploited that in positive ways.
Very clever. And she was also very gracious to her guests and would send a handwritten postcard, which at a time when the post office worked more expediently, would arrive a day after the interview.
Hard to imagine.
Yeah. She also responded to listener feedback and would personally write up to 400 postcards daily, you wrote in your book, and in red pencil for some reason.
They're quite distinctive. And, you know, many of them are at the Library of Congress, as are some of these letters. And she had regular correspondents who sort of thought of her as a member of the family. And then they would write to her and send her flowers on the anniversary of her mother's death or on her birthday. They really felt connected.
So we're conducting this interview remotely. You're in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the moment, and remote work is a well-established practice at this point in our history. Mary Margaret McBride was a pioneer. Can you talk about the fluidity with which she shifted between studio recording and home recording or broadcasting. She was blazing some paths there.
Well, she was blazing many paths. I think that if she had her druthers, she would always want to have her guest in the studio with her. And she also liked having a studio audience. But because of developments in the broadcasting world, there was the possibility to be having guests remotely or broadcasting from places other than a studio, which now this is what we do all the time. And as you say, she was very much ahead of her time.
You had a story about her interview with Gary Cooper in her Central Park South apartment, and she heard the banging of pipes next door and an adjacent apartment. This is something everyone who's ever used Zoom in a meeting can relate to, things like this happening. And so she, or maybe it was Stella,
yeah,
who went and asked them if they could stop. And they said, we'll stop if we can meet Gary Cooper. So they wound up coming in being part of the show. And she had a hard time getting them off the air.
Well, you know, that's a perfect Mary Margaret story. The you know, ingenuity of, you know, there's this banging that's obtrusive, but then just incorporating them in. And then, of course, it becomes one of those stories that gets handed down by her listeners. It'll be sort of like, oh, yeah, remember the story about Gary Cooper and the plumbers, whether they actually heard it at the time or not. But it often got referred to so many times that people thought they had. And there was another one where Mary Margaret was a large woman. And back in those days, women wore corsets. And you zipped yourself into them, which was always a challenge, I guess. And one time she got her ample flesh caught in the zipper and had to get a doctor who lived in her building, her apartment building, to come and basically undo the zipper and bandage her back. And so she was 10 or 15 minutes late to her show. And instead of just saying, I'm sorry, I'm late, she said, well, let me tell you what happened. It's the most embarrassing thing, but maybe it's happened to you. And so she tells this story. It's basically a story on herself, you know, that she's so ample and fat that she gets stuck in her corset. And of course, it gets picked up by the wire services. And she's kind of surprised because she honestly, I think, thought she was just telling her audience. It was like she was telling a friend this. And she forgets that she's got 6 or 8 million people listening to her every day. But that story then, again, enters the sort of pantheon of Mary Margaret McBride stories, whereas I think by the end of her time on the radio, probably most listeners would say, oh, yes, I heard that when it happened, where really all they had heard was it had been mentioned over and over. But again, it sort of builds a sense of a community. It's a community of listeners, and they feel part of this, and they feel connected to her.
You mentioned in your book that she herself did not consume media. Do you think that that played a big role in the types of interviews she conducted and the way that she kind of presented herself?
Well, I think there's a notable absence of ego in some ways. When she's doing her interviews, she's not trying to grab the spotlight. She's not really going for attention, but she's not staying in the background. She wants to have a conversation that really shows off her guest. And I think that is often unusual among especially successful media types who tend to have rather large egos on screen and off. And she really was much more self-effacing. Now, her own ego was quite fragile. She was incredibly insecure. She could have the best show in the world, but she'd think something was wrong with it, or she'd be worried about whether she could replicate, do another one just as good the next day. I mean, she was never really satisfied with what she did. But I do think that this quality in her that really put the guest first was one reason why these interviews turned out so well.
And as much as she loved her guests, she had two rules. One is that her guests couldn't have notes or preparation, so no one got their questions in advance.
I have no notes, none.
Yeah, we're replicating that here.
I did write a book about it, but...
And her show had to be first. So if you had Tennessee Williams and he was promoting a new play and he appeared on another show first, forget it.
Yeah.
Uninvited by Mary Margaret.
Yeah. And she had the power to enforce that. I mean, it was also Stella who was enforcing it. But, you know, with Eleanor Roosevelt, she would get first dibs when Mrs. Roosevelt had a new book. And that was true of many other people because they respected her. And they respected her bond with the audience. They knew it was in their interest to do this. But I think that is a good example that she's not just all sweetness and light. I mean, she's out to keep her position at the top of the game. And she was able to do that. And, you know, it really is a range of people, you know, Tennessee Williams and other playwrights and actors and soldiers during the war. Her friends would fill in. We haven't really talked about her announcer, Vincent Connolly, who was what was then called a confirmed bachelor.
It's 1 o'clock, and this is Vincent Connolly introducing the Mary Margaret McBride program.
So the sexual politics of this show are really interesting when you look back. You've got a gay man as the announcer. You've got Stella and Mary Margaret. Who knows what their relationship was. And they're mainly talking to presumably heterosexual housewives. But Vincent is very much part of the show because he helps her do the products. He sort of gives her prompts and whatever. And so her listeners really felt that they knew Vincent and they would, write in suggestions for him and how he might meet somebody, and it's really quite something.
Are there any comparisons that you can make today to someone who either interviews like Mary Margaret or has the influence to push brands like Mary Margaret did or anything like that that maybe she pioneered but other people kind of picked up?
Well, the obvious one is Oprah Winfrey, and I'm no authority on her, but I think you can see how, in terms of a bond with her listeners, promoting books and other things, dealing with topics that come out of her own personal life and sharing them with her audience, that there are many parallels. But the world that we inhabit now in terms of media and exposure and what gets talked about and how it's done on television is really worlds away from the world of radio in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, which was Mary Margaret McBride's main period. But I do think there are parallels, and there are also parallels to the kind of talk show like, you know, the Today Show with authors. Now, did Mary Margaret McBride get any credit for that? Of course not. She's sort of forgotten. I'm convinced that, you know, if she were alive today, she would have her own podcast. There's no question in my mind. She'd be doing it from that barn she converted in the Catskills. And she wouldn't really care about how many people listen, but she would love it. And the technology would be pretty simple. She could manage it and she would always have something to say and she would just think it's great. So maybe in that way, what you're doing is really carrying on the legacy of Mary Margaret McBride.
Well, that is an excerpt from the Catskills podcast Brett Berry produces about Mary Margaret McBride, First Lady of Radio. Fascinating. It's amazing history to know that she was just here in our neck of the woods doing it.
Yeah, fascinating individual. I wish I had a chance to meet her, but, it's not going to happen because she passed away the same year I was born. So we crossed paths, but what a fascinating story.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it to us. And you can hear the full episode at your website. And tell folks where that is.
Yeah, CatsCast, CatsCast.com, or any podcast app. New stories every 2 weeks. So thank you so much for putting a spotlight on this one, Tim. I appreciate it.
We appreciate you bringing it to us, and appreciate you bringing and keeping this history alive, too. The Cats Cast podcast is also on our website, wjffradio.org. While you're there, maybe consider donating in honor of Mary Margaret McBride.
Yeah, she would love that.
WJFFradio.org or call 845-482-4141. It's our spring fund drive. We're 27% of the way through. We only have about $400 to meet that $15,000 mark. So help us out. What can you do? 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Britt Barry, thank you so much for being here. And
Thanks, Tim. We'll
see you again. We'll want to feature some more of your great work on the show.
Come back. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, culture reporter Valerie Manzi has a few friends to talk about an artist talk tonight at the Derby. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, my name is Samuel O'Hurst Kessler. I'm a producer on the Planet Money podcast.
My name is Claudia Pescuta, and I'm a supervising editor on NPR's Morning Edition.
My name is Sachi Kobayashi, and I'm a director of collaborative philanthropy at NPR.
My name is Devin Meller. I'm the operations manager for NPR's New York Bureau. My high school creative writing teacher introduced me to public radio.
I'm jokingly what's called a backseat baby.
I did not grow up listening to public radio, but I discovered it at some point and fell in love with the news coverage and shows like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
I got my introduction to radio by working at WXPN in Philadelphia. And on my first day, I realized that everyone there was there to serve the listeners, no one else.
However you found public radio, you can be part of the community that makes it possible.
Please give to this station today. Here's how.
Support Radio Catskill during our spring fund drive. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Or call 845-482-4141 or again, WJFFradio.org. Thanks to Catherine in New York City who just donated online. Thank you very much for your donation. And now we just have about, looks like a little over $300 to go to get to that $15,000 mark in the drive. So let's do it. 845-482-4141, sorry, or WJFFradio.org. Val was going to her purse, and I thought she dropped something, but she's just picking up some notes there. Valerie Manzi, our culture reporter, is here to talk to us and talk to a couple of friends she has.
Yes, I'm very happy to have Megan Newbeck and Randall Lane here today.
Hello, guys.
Yes, and they'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Derby, giving an artist talk as a part of the Color of Thread exhibit that's been up there.
That's the textile exhibit.
It is about textiles. So they're here to tell us about it.
Megan, tell us a little bit about your work.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a natural dye textile artist, and I do large landscapes. I love to draw from like just the colors of the earth, really.
Yeah.
And I also do apparel, and I do local dyeing for like local artisans.
All right. Yeah. And you've been up in this exhibit has been up for a minute at the Derby. Is it an artist talk tonight with you and Randall?
Tomorrow night.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry, I had it wrong. So tomorrow night at the Derby. Randall, scoot over there toward the mic. We're shuffling in around here. Well, tell us a little bit about your work.
The work that I've done for the show at the Derby is obviously textile based. Tell you about my work. Well, sort of all over the place, if you will.
10 seconds or less.
I was graphic designer for a long time, and that sort of went away. And during COVID, before COVID, my wife and I were doing interior design and corporate event design. And then we just moved into pivoted to furniture and getting back into making art again.
And now this exhibit has been up for a little bit. And what's the reaction been to this textile based exhibit at the Derby?
Well, we've had great support by the community. Each time we've done an event, a lot of people have showed up. We haven't yet sold any pieces, so pieces are available. But like I said, everybody's been coming out, and Avi at the Derby has been great. And it's just been fun to interact with people and look at art together.
Val, did you have some...
Yes. I wanted to say we're sharing mics here, so a little slow on the uptake. Okay, well, I've been to the artist talks, and they're great fun, and it's a real community spirit, and we have a community spirit right here at WJFF. correct, Tim?
We do. It's very, very community oriented, especially with listeners who are donating during our spring fund drive. 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. Donate now to support all of the great news, information, and entertainment that you hear on the station. And including, I would just say, I'm going to toot our own horn here this morning, where we got to learn something new about a radio pioneer in our area.
Absolutely.
Now we're talking to some textile art pioneers in our area. So we try to do that every day when we bring folks into the community.
And Megan, you have workshops that you also do. Can you tell us a little bit about those workshops?
Absolutely. I actually have a workshop coming up on May 18th. It's going to be from 5 to 6:30 at Woolworth, Layla's shop in Calicoon. She has these amazing knit, like they're called sock blanks.
Okay.
And so we're going to bundle dye with them and use natural dye extracts. And then you take them home and you dry them out and then you re-knit them into a pair of socks.
This sounds
how fun.
Whoa.
This,
not I'm not
fun?
A knitter. It sounds fun, but it sounds, is it hard for somebody who has never knitted before? What about a beginner? Can somebody do that?
Layla is a great teacher and she will teach you how
okay.
to knit.
Got it.
Okay. And then the bundle dyeing will be so much fun. You'll see all, you can create your own color pattern.
Megan, what drew you first to this area of art?
I'm sorry?
What drew you to this area, this textile art area for you? What was it that drew you to it? You know, instead of paint or, you know,
oh, yes.
other forms?
I think it was preserving the land. So I first got really deep. I've been in the denim industry for most of my life, for 18 years. And we bought a cabin by the Rondout Reservoir. And so being so close to the watershed district, I was like, oh, I can no longer use, I would use dioxide in my indigo vats. And I was like, I can no longer do that. I want to preserve the water. So I went all natural. And then that just expanded. And I just kept foraging and like using all natural materials and yes.
Was it a difficult transition to from something that was more commercially produced to something out of nature?
Oh, I love it. It's slow and beautiful.
So you were able to find those alternatives and things that were actually even more meaningful because of where you found it.
Absolutely. And I just completed a project with Madewell. So we did a small capsule collection that was all naturally dyed. So
wow.
We're bringing it to the masses.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
Randall, I will ask you the same kind of question. Like, what, and Val, you're going to have to give him the mic. what drew you to the textile side of this art, of art?
Well, when I was younger, my mother was a hobby seamstress, but she was really good at it. So I've always sort of been around the working with cloth and things like that. And I don't know, I saw the G's Bend quilt show years ago in the city, and quilts have always been in the back of my head. So I was like, let's try some patchwork things. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
Yeah. And is it sort of like that organic thought process for you and sort of like, let's just try this and see what comes out of it? Or do you have something plotted out in advance or is it a combination of the
two? It's a combination of that. Really, I sort of like to follow my curiosities a lot in the work that I do, whether it's furniture or art or even graphic design, things like that. It's I get interested in a thing and I research it and then I eventually do something with all of that abstract knowledge that I take into my head.
Now, I you know, when Megan was talking about the knitting part of it, and I said, oh, that sounds scary, and I'm a beginner. How do I do that? What is it you want folks to know about, like, textile art and to not be afraid of it, really? Like, how to dive into it? I guess what I'm saying is, like, some folks might think of art and think, oh, paint, I can do that. I can paint things. But textile art, to me, seems like it involves a little bit more skill or knowledge. But what would you say to someone who's a beginner or new to it?
Well, I think, you know, we're surrounded by textiles all the time, our clothes. Obviously, things like that. And I think it's easy to take something that you're no longer using and cut it up and do something with it. Take a sewing machine, sew some pieces together, just throw caution to the wind.
I like that. And do you have a similar kind of thought process when it comes to using more natural types of things in your work, as Megan was describing? She was talking specifically about natural dyes, but you're talking about like pieces that may have been cast off or...
Yeah, goods. Definitely recycled goods or upcycling of things, you know, throwaway things. Some of the pieces I use, just drop cloths that I have used for furniture making. Mm-hmm. So they just have paint splatter on them. So just repurposing things seems apropos today, these days.
Art is everywhere. You just know where to look. Val.
Could you speak a little bit about your furniture design?
Well, pre-COVID, we were actually working on a trade show booth for Unilever, and we had already bought about $2,000 worth of plywood. And then, of course, that trade show.
Don't mean to laugh. Just the way it goes.
It's funny now.
That
trade show was, of course, canceled, and I had to figure out something to do with $2,000 worth of plywood, pre-COVID prices of plywood. So it was a large pile, and I had some tools, so I just started designing some prototypes and putting them together. This was when we were still mostly down in the city. Our studio was in Ridgewood, and that's sort of how I pivoted to furniture from graphic design and design build.
Megan, you know, it's our Spring Fun Drive. You may have heard. And we're asking folks how they discovered public radio, how they discovered Radio Catskill, and what the station means to them. What does it mean to you? Do you mind me asking that?
Oh, I listen all the time. I think on weekends, on Saturdays, they have the fishing game or the fishing report.
Yes.
I love it
Farm
so much.
Farm and Country, Rosie Starr. Yes.
It's amazing. And I just listen to NPR. I listen to like WNYC all the time to get all the news that's going on there. I listen up here. It's a great news outlet because you're going to get well-rounded, great news
and local life. Perspectives as well local and hear from local folks like yourself. And we were talking earlier with Lisa Lyons from Morgan Outdoors, and she was talking about how when she came out from the city and would listen to WNYC and then would hear the thing she was listening to there when she transitioned past Middletown into the area, but then also the local stuff we have. And there's something about public radio that is that continuum, right? I know that whenever I travel around, I'm always at the left-hand side of the dial and I'm looking for that public radio station because that's what I want to hear. But then you get something so specific and local to a station like Radio Catskill, like Farm and Country and Hooked on Fishing.
And this program is, I love it.
And Rael, I'll just ask you the same question. What is it that you know you value about Radio Catskill?
Yeah, well, Judy, my wife, and I have been longtime members of WNYC, and we've given, and I'm going to give when I walk out of the studio to the fundraiser here. And like you said, it's one, the local news is great. The national news through NPR is obviously very important. And your music programming is incredible here at Radio Catskill.
We have such great local music programs, and they're all volunteer produced. These folks, we don't pay them. They want to do it, and they're great. Last night, Kusar Grace and the Music Emporium. Tomorrow night, we've got our all-original lineup of Ramble Tamble at 7, followed by Connect the Dots with David Christensen, and then also right after that, a new show, Matt Hurtado, who's doing a show about the music in video games. And also interviews with video game industry professionals. He works in that industry. And so that is a cool thing. And video games are huge. That show's not anywhere else. It's here.
Yeah, that's an innovative idea for a show.
Yeah, fantastic. So many other great things. Check it out, wjffradio.org. Check the schedule. But also donate it to us at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. I want to thank you guys for your kind words and for your support. But also let's remind folks about your talk tomorrow at the Darby.
Correct. The Darby, right across from Narrowsburg in Pennsylvania, is from 6 to 8 in the lobby of the Darby. And the Darby will have their bar, Delphine, open for drinks and snacks.
All right. Thank you guys so much for coming by. And we look forward to having you back again, because I know you're going to have more shows throughout the year, and we'll have you back again. And Valerie Manzi, culture reporter Valerie Manzi. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Megan. And we are going to wrap it up here. We're running out of time to get to the Youth Poetry Festival, but we're going to talk to Sharon Kennedy Knoll after this, and we'll bring you that interview tomorrow so we can talk about all the great youth poetry and all the great work that Sharon is doing as the Sullivan County Poet Laureate. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, I'm Daniel Estrin, NPR correspondent in the Middle East. I have spent the past few months covering a devastating war, working with colleagues in Gaza and Israel. NPR has dozens of journalists covering Israeli and Palestinian stories of anguish and survival. When you support this station, you invest in NPR's international coverage. Please give today and help us bear witness.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill, WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Local news, culture, and NPR. On Point is next, and the forecast, cooler with a few showers around today, high 61. Right now, it's 49 degrees outside of our studios here in Liberty. It looks like the rain is going to continue tonight through Friday afternoon, and maybe some thunderstorms and wind tomorrow. It's our Spring Fund Drive. Donate now at 845-482-4141 or go to WJFFradio.org. Make a donation of any amount. We've heard from a few folks today, and we are looking to hear from a few more. We're just about $300 short of $15,000 raised so far in the drive. If you can help with some part of that or all of it, give us a call, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. It's 11 o'clock.